Hi, everyone, and welcome to the special simulcast of The Neil Haley Show and also Freedom from Addiction on Libsyn, Truth Just Below the Surface, and all my syndicated channels and Wynn syndicated channels. And I'm excited to welcome the program, Reverend Wynn Henderson, MD. Wynn, how are you? International breaking news you're bringing us today.
Yeah, Neil, you know, I try to research and find the truth that the public needs to know, which is just below the surface, but which they may never find out about because of the agenda that the newscasters and other people in government want to push. So we've got something new for you today. It's going to be terrifically exciting. We're going to talk about intestinal inoculation versus vaccination. And This is something that you've never heard of before. This is an exclusive worldwide broadcast. And our guest today is Dr. Stephen Mark Hayden. He's a medical doctor, in which we have several things in common. Neither of us graduated from high school. We went to college early. We both graduated from a Class A United States medical school. In this particular case, the University of Alabama School of Medicine. I graduated in 1972, and Mark graduated in 1986. Mark graduated when he was 24 years old, and I graduated when I was 23 years old. We're both born-again Christians. We both have a purpose in life, and we know what that purpose is. We both wanted to be scientists and inventors and make a difference in the world. And we have both received one or more United States medical patents. Mark's childhood was influenced by several things. One was his mother's death from a malignant melanoma when he was 11 years old. He learned what death and disease were like by watching his mother die slowly and painfully. A second influence was his distrust of government because of his father's and uncle's relationship to the CIA. As a child, he learned that government will often hide the truth. He learned that it's okay if you're not like everybody else, which he wasn't. He learned that others have different beliefs on religion and truth. He learned he must decide what he would believe about religion, but not impose that on others. Mark's websites are www.antivirusair.com and www.digestivecovid.com. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
You and I have agreed to a series of interviews. I don't know how long the series will be, but it's going to talk about significant medical problems in the United States today, and that is the Corona 19 pandemic and what to do about it. Now, in this initial podcast, part one, we will talk about your childhood, education, scientific experiences, and define what you have learned about gastrointestinal inoculation and several other concepts relating to COVID-19. So let's get started, Mark. Tell us about your childhood, education, and scientific experience. You are a certified urgent care specialist and a medical doctor.
Yes. You know, first of all, I was very blessed to be born in the United States. My father had retired as a major in the Air Force, and he was a patriotic person. One of the most painful things I ever experienced was seeing my mother die. And there was a point in her life, she had chemo for like 3 years when she had malignant melanoma and she had radiation. She lost down to like 85 pounds. And as a young boy, I saw her give up hope. And that profoundly affected me because I saw her literally waste away and slowly die in front of my eyes. And at some point, she actually gave up and accepted that she wasn't going to make it. And that affected me and made me want to make every day count, because we don't live forever. None of us do. All of us have a time to go. And for each of us, we have to make the most use of our time. Now, when COVID came along, I was good at having a one-on-one relationship with patients. I could hold their hand. I could smile at them. I could be personal. When the COVID epidemic happened, suddenly there was all this fear that I would inhale something that I could not even see. I was worried that with every breath I took, it could be contaminated. And that really interfered a lot in my relationship with people, with patients. It made it very uncomfortable. I was a big advocate for using ionized air. And I had a background to where I look at a lot of international media. One of my websites is Antivirus Air. And it discusses ionization and aerosol of the virus. Well, in just the last few weeks, the CDC has finally admitted there are aerosol. My website said that months ago at Antivirus Air. These things were not admitted up front, even though there was very strong evidence that it could be aerosolized all the way back in January and February, when it was spread in super spreader events over in Korea. So the real scientific community has known a long time, probably at least 8, 9, 10 months, that aerosol spread does occur. I understand that they wanted people to wear masks. That's obvious. So they didn't tell people it would aerosol spread because they didn't want to discourage people from wearing their mask. Now, the government can decide what they want people to know. And I get that. If we remember in history, the government decided that we wouldn't know about the atom bomb until it was actually dropped on Japanese people, even though they'd been working on it for years. So it should come as no surprise to us that people inside government know a lot more about coronavirus than they're letting us know. What would be the first question? I don't want to go off on a tangent, and I'm interested in whatever y'all would like to ask me about. So,
okay, so your education was?
My education was I got a medical degree from the University of Alabama. When I went to med school, I wanted to really be a scientist. I really didn't want to practice medicine. I wanted to primarily make a difference in the scientific community. So one of the first things I did was to pay for research equipment. I went and started in the ER in 1988. And I started working in the ER, and I have worked off and on for almost 30 years in the emergency room. So I used my medical practice to pay for my research projects. And over the years, I've had some very interesting research projects and multiple patents in multiple fields. Now, I had done a project. I had done two projects that were somewhat related to COVID. Let me explain those connections. I did a project with ultrasound and spores, where I was sterilizing spores. And in that project, we would separate the spores so that heat could be better effectively applied. I actually sold a piece of research equipment to Tropicana. But I came to understand about sterilization of spores and how things can be, that technology can be used to disperse pathogens. So when I was on the internet early in January, and I heard about how one woman spread it to literally of hundreds of people at one time in one church meeting, I knew from that report that the aerosol spread had occurred over there in South Korea. And that was in probably early January or early February. And so it was spreading as an aerosol. And it was anybody who knew how pathogens are spread would have looked at that event. And they would have known that that was aerosol spread. That argument and that debate went on for until 2 weeks ago. But the truth was always there. They just wanted to ignore it because they wanted to force people to wear a face mask. Now, even knowing that aerosol spread does occur, I will wear a face mask when I go out to Home Depot or when I go out to, if I go out to Lowe's and everybody else is. If I want to be a team player, a lot of times I wear a face mask just so I can be one of the guys, one of the team. But it doesn't mean that that face mask, that I even believe that that face mask is necessarily protecting me. I'm sure it protects me to some small degree. But it's just not realistic to think that with billions and trillions of virus in the environment, that you're going to be able to avoid it. It's unavoidable. This recent infection at the White House, if the White House cannot protect itself with its budget, what chance does the common man have? It should be fairly obvious that Americans are going to be exposed. They will be exposed, and many have been exposed. Now, we know that at least 7 million people have positive PCR tests. We don't know the exact number that have had exposure. So that exposure number might be 30 million. It might be 50 million. We might have 100 million Americans that have had 5 or 10 virus on their food, or 5 or 10,000 virus on their food when they ate it. We don't know. So if you're trying to talk about a case fatality rate, what is a case? Is a case only when I get a positive PCR? We have people in this community who are listening to this broadcast. Are you going to say, if you get positive and you're positive in your mouth, if you chose not to get tested, sooner or later, your mouth will clear it out 99% of the time. And you will not even appear as a case, even though it was in your mouth. And if you had been tested at the right time, it would have been positive. So the actual number of cases is probably 3 to 5 times at least what we're being told.
And, okay. So let's see. I think we'll go now to say that you have a medical patent on inoculating the digestive tract with COVID virus. And we're going to talk about that more in detail in our part 2 of this discussion, which will be next week. So everybody that's listening to this to find out the actual details need to come back next week and subscribe to the podcast so that you know when we're going to be putting this terrifically important information up.
And I have a question. Yeah, I have a question real quick, Wynn. Stephen, so basically you really have researched this since the pandemic's come and have looked at specifically how it's really being spread. in so many aspects, getting up to this point now where you're creating a patent for a product that's going to help hopefully end the coronavirus or help decrease the coronavirus, from looking at the whole world, or are you looking just in the United States?
I applied for this as a U.S. patent. And Neil, one of the things that really motivates you to study is encountering a virus that is potentially make me very, very sick and is associated with death. So there's nothing like motivating me to study an issue as much as anticipation that I was going to do inoculation on myself. So literally for months, I studied everything that I could get on the internet, everything, because I was anticipating inoculating myself. So it's kind of like having, you ever heard of the skin in the game? Well,
right. Yeah.
I didn't want to botch it up, because if you look at the history of inoculation, when smallpox was around, smallpox had a death rate of about 30%. Now imagine that. That death rate with smallpox was 30 times at least higher than what COVID is. They had inoculation back then, and there were deaths associated with inoculation, but it was only about 5% or less of the death rate compared to getting it smallpox accidentally. Right now, we have an undetermined death rate and sickness rate with COVID in the communities. And people want to know how they can protect themselves. I understand that. But inoculation has always existed as an alternative before there is safe vaccination available. And that's what history shows us with smallpox. So it was a logical way to investigate and a logical way to proceed.
Okay, so Mark, one of your doctors that's an emergency room physician in Troy, Alabama, his name is Richard Slomer. Did I pronounce that last name right?
Yes.
Okay. Your colleague said that while we wait for a safe vaccine, which will stimulate the immune response, and we're told that a vaccine will take 9 to 18 months to be available, and that investigation needs to be done to determine whether there is a more rapid way to establish COVID immunity. He states that you have an innovative idea that might offer a safe method to provide immunization now. So my question is, how did you get involved with being the first physician in the world to inoculate yourself with live COVID virus?
Here's how that happens. One of the things that physicians can do is just become automatons to just spit out whatever the CDC or FDA says. Physicians are supposed to be thinkers. A lot of the smartest people in your community were physicians. But physicians, a lot of time in their entire practice, will never have a new patent. They'll never do anything unique. What they will do is only practice the standard of care. And the standard of care will be determined by the profession. And the profession of medicine will be run by the people with the money who want to make the rules. So, unfortunately, many physicians will go through their entire life not doing anything unique in medicine, even though they were some of the smartest people in their class. And the way I got involved in it was I saw an article that said that COVID, the coronavirus, is both a respiratory as well as GI virus. And we know from just community experience that it infects people's intestinal tract. Some people get severe symptoms. They get repeated bouts of nausea and vomiting. But it's very often that people get just mild symptoms or no GI symptoms. And yet you can still culture it out in their stool when, if you can get the PCR in their stool, when they've had few or no symptoms. So if you look at me in particular, I was able to grow it in my intestinal tract with only one mildly loose stool. That's all I had. No fever, no chills, no nausea and vomiting. And guess what? That may be happening across America. So we have listeners, and they are around people where they're exposed to SARS-CoV. Let's just call it the COVID virus. And we'll just call it COVID. They're exposed to people with COVID. Are they? Is their GI tract getting exposed to COVID when they're eating food from takeout? Yes. And so really what is going on is we're exposing our GI tracts all the time. And that's giving us our intestines the opportunity to develop a defense. So I got into this primarily because I had freedom of thought, freedom to think. We all need, and it's not just about COVID, we need to analyze issues for ourselves. We don't need the government to decide what is good science. We're smart people. Your listeners are smart people. They should be able to make up their own decisions about their health and their life. You know, and we forget that we are thinking people. We should be able to examine the evidence for ourselves, whether it's about face masks or aerosols or anything else. We're thinkers. And through discussion and dialogue, hey, we can come up with solutions.
Well, we're going to get into this starting next week on part two for the specifics. But I just wanted to bring up two, and it's not major points, but I heard the other day that the president was taking famotidine, otherwise known as Pepcid, which is over-the-counter. Anybody can get it at the drugstore, 80 milligrams three times a day, as one of the medications he was using to treat his COVID infection. Now, can you give us a fairly brief but adequate discussion on how Pepcid would help a person with this COVID problem?
Absolutely. Pepcid, or famotidine, is probably one of the safest medicines you can take. Aspirin actually can give you an ulcer if you take too much of it or you have certain proclivities, but aspirin is generally very safe and people take it for years. Pepcid can be gotten over the counter. You don't need a doctor's prescription. Let's look for a minute at the role of stomach acid. Viruses are in the room in which your listener is. There are viruses in that room. Is it hundreds, thousands, millions? Viruses are all over the place. And when we eat, a lot of times they're going to be on the food. They go down to our stomach, and our stomach acid, it helps dissolve, it helps to kill the virus. However, so stomach acid helps kill the virus, but then the president takes something that reduces acid. That doesn't seem to make sense until you think about it. When he took Pepcid, he reduced his stomach acid to the point that more virus reached his small intestine. In a way, the healing process and the immune system began to accelerate because the virus passed through his stomach and began to reach his small intestine. So immunity comes about when the virus reaches the small intestine. And that immune process is actually helped by Pepcid because more virus passes through the stomach and reaches the small intestine. So is Pepcid a wonderful idea if you know that you have COVID? Yes. So if you're positive for COVID and you know that you've got the COVID virus on your tongue or your nose, do a from a rapid test or from a PCR test, is it a good idea that you be on Pepcid? Yes, it's an excellent idea. Now, I'm going to put in some limitations on that. Some of the local communities are running out of over-the-counter famotidine. If you're just 20 years old, you're in such a low-risk category, why even go out and get the Pepcid? That may be, save it for your granddaddy or your parents that are in their 50s and 60s. But is Pepcid an excellent idea? Absolutely. Now, here's something that you can do today that I would definitely recommend. It turns out that even though that Pepcid or famotidine is associated with good outcomes, Prilosec is actually associated with bad outcomes during a COVID epidemic.
Wow.
Yes. And now that many of the listeners out there are going to be on Prilosec or Protonix or what's called protein pump inhibitors, let me say something good about that for the manufacturers of these. These are great drugs when you have peptic ulcers, an acute peptic ulcer. And in fact, when proton pump inhibitors came around, they helped protect from very serious peptic ulcer disease. They were part of that treatment protocol. However, during a pandemic, if you get COVID on your tongue and you're taking Pepcid, and you're taking Prilosec, a proton pump inhibitor, that's not a good idea. Because that's associated with a like twofold risk of death in some Chinese studies. And here can be some of the reasons for it. Originally, our stomachs are great at digesting protein. Remember, protein's on all the food we eat. And in fact, the FDA even tells you how much protein is in each serving of food. And that's great. But remember that that when we eat the virus, if we eat a bunch of protein with it, that protein that is undigested protein may go down to the small bowel. And that undigested protein may affect how the immune system processes that virus. That virus, when it's in your small intestine, has to enter your small bowel cells. And when it enters those cells, it can carry with it undigested proteins. And it's very possible, it's likely, that those undigested proteins actually are associated with an impaired immune response. Now, if you look at the statistics on COVID, and I tell you how to, for lay people. Thin women and thin men do far better than obese women or obese men. And people that binge eat protein will do worse. Now, that might seem a mystery. And in fact, if you ask, call up the CDC. Ask the guys, the experts at the CDC, hey, how come obese men do worse? And they will say, we don't know. But I have an explanation for you. Obesity is associated with overeating. Now, in full disclosure, I overeat myself. When I go on Thanksgiving, I really overeat. And I'm trying to lose 20 pounds. I'm not at my ideal body weight. I wish I was. So I sympathize with people that have been on diets for 20 years because I've been trying to lose weight for 20 years. But the healthier somebody is on their waist size, on their eating habits, the more likely they are to have less disease and less mortality or less death. So if you're in an area where you're exposed to COVID, eat in moderation, take your Pepcid, don't take Prilosec or Protonix, and practice eating like a bird. We know publicly that about 20 people were infected at the White House. If you check on those people at the White House, here's what you'll find. The skinny women who eat like a bird, the skinny men that eat with moderation, they will have much milder disease than obese men. But the people that are having this most severe disease, the strongest factor is obesity. And so that is a huge issue in who gets sick and who doesn't. So this is part of a lifestyle disease. Now, in medicine, we have all sorts of lifestyle disease, obesity, smoking, and doctors don't become millionaires by recommending healthy lifestyles. But it's healthy lifestyles that are really make the difference in our lives about our quality of life. And that's what we need to pursue. So, you know, is Pepcid a wonderful idea? Yes, especially for those who are older than 60 years old. We know that most of the death rate is around 80. If I'm just 30, do I want to save that Pepcid or Famotidine for my grandfather or my parents? That's the right thing to do, unless they have plenty. And if you're young, you need to share your Pepcid with older people that are at higher risk. But you can begin to understand how Pepcid works. And Pepcid would not work unless more virus was actually passing from their stomach into their small intestine in certain cases. So that's how the Pepcid works.
Okay, Mark, we're running toward the end of the program. I've got one other question, and if you could give me a quick answer. The president also used melatonin as part of his treatment regimen. And can you come up with any ideas why melatonin, a hormone that causes the sleep system to change, would be something that he would be recommending?
Well, you know, for myself, I use a sleep monitor every night. You can get those wristwatches where you monitor your sleep and you look at deep sleep, light sleep, REM sleep. I think those are great ideas. And I personally, I'm always trying to improve my sleep pattern. And people that sleep better that has an effect on the immune system. Now, melatonin is very well known to be related to sleep cycles. And it's likely that sleep cycles affect how well your natural immune response is. Now, I haven't studied that issue in detail, so I am in no way an expert on melatonin because I just don't have the background on that. That is not something that, if you talk to me about digestive COVID, I would understand that much. You could look at, I can explain to you why, for instance, why is vitamin D associated with good outcomes? Because vitamin D is absorbed through the small intestine. It's part of intestinal health. So the higher your natural levels of vitamin D, the better intestinal health you likely have.
Okay, we'll get on to vitamin D and other things in our next program. We're going to wrap this one up. And would you just tell the people that are listening how to get in touch with you, how you would prefer for them to get in touch with you if they want your expertise on this matter?
We have a website, Antivirus Air, LLC. If you contact that website, we'll be glad to try to get back and respond to you. There's a lot of interesting issues here, and we'd be glad to talk in more detail. I don't want to bore your listeners with a lot of technical details, and yet I do want to be thorough and fair. And I appreciate the chance to talk to y'all.
That website, you said LLC, is that in the...
No, that is not. No, it's Antivirus Air. AntiVirusAir.com.
All right. Wow. I tell you, great information, something that is breaking news, and look forward to part two next week when really great information.
Yeah, Neil, let me say that the people that are listening to this show, not only should they make it go viral and tell all their friends about my podcast, which they can get to with their telephone or their computer by going to www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn.com, spelling Libsyn, L-I-B as in boy, S-Y-N, no spaces, no capitals. It'll take you right now, as soon as we put this one up, it'll take you to that one, and you can scroll back and see over 200 different programs. So subscribe to it, get the latest truth just below the surface, and tell all your friends and neighbors.
Thanks again. All great information. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Neil.
All right, guys, that was the Freedom from Addiction Neil Haley Show. Take care, everyone.